CityTalk 105.9 official podcasts. Online at citytalk.fm. Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. CityTalk 105.9.
Good morning and welcome to City Talks Business with me, Frank McKenna. I'm the chairman of the Independent Private Sector Lobby Group and Business Networking Club Downtown Liverpool in Business. And every Sunday, I'll be taking a look at some of the week's big business stories and talking to some key personalities, decision makers and entrepreneurs who work in and influence Liverpool and the wider Northwest region. This week, Chancellor George Osborne finally announced the details of his comprehensive spending review. Are we going to hell in a handcart? Or will his actions be good for the UK economy? Liverpool hosted the MOBO Awards, an event that generated some £10 million into the local economy. But with the City Council having to five 7% cuts for the next 4 years, can our local authority continue to help financing this type of activity? The property firm Mippin has already been abandoned. How many other promotional and marketing initiatives could fall by the wayside? Talking of which, the city's involvement in Shanghai has been hailed as a success. We'll be talking to someone who's just back from China. How can we build on the work that's taken place over in China during the past 12 months? We'll be exploring all this and more, I'm sure, with my guests this week, who include political commentator extraordinaire Jim Hancock, a former political editor for both BBC Northwest and Granada, now a columnist for both EM Business Magazine and the Liverpool Daily Post. The ultimate wordsmith and head honcho of Aurora Media, John Egan, is with us, along with Paul Flanagan, the managing director of the Flanagan Group, and joining us, as always, the downtown events manager, Roger Jonas. Good morning to you all.
Good morning, Good morning, Frank.
We'll obviously start with the big news of the week, which has been the comprehensive spending review. I was actually in the Commons on Wednesday to hear the delivery of all the good, bad and indifferent news. I went on the basis that I'd heard the public executions are quite an eventful thing to go and watch, and I wasn't disappointed. It was difficult to actually get into the detail of what Osborne was saying, because an awful lot of it was still, well, this department's going to cut X and this department's going to cut Y. So the implications, the impact, I think, is still really to be identified. What I would say, though, is the cut that really jumped out at me was 7% every year for the next 4 years for local authorities across the board. And of course, in Liverpool, City Council is already facing a massive deficit within its budget anyway. And it just seems to me that that could be an area where people are locally going to struggle to identify with what the Chancellor's objectives are. How can our local economy continue to grow with public sector cuts coming along to that extent? And I wonder, Jim, if I may come to you first. Firstly, the impact of those public sector cuts on the North West, and secondly, what you actually made of Osborne's overall performance.
Yes, well, I mean, the public sector thing is obviously, you're quite right to draw attention to it straight away because we are so dependent on it. Now, in a sense, the challenge for the Merseyside economy is to wean ourselves off that, because with no disrespect to anybody who works in the public service, most of whom do a really good job, it is not a healthy balance for our economy. But the question is going to be whether this shock therapy is actually going to work. And the key question for me is the private sector in a position to actually mop up these jobs? Are we going to see fairly smooth transfers of people who've been used to the public sector going over to the private sector? I mean, I've already heard, leading up to this weekend, private business people saying that they can't, at the moment, compete with the public sector with their pensions and with their flexible working hours and all that sort of thing. They want to employ people, and in truth, not an awful lot above the minimum wage in some cases in the retail sector, and they can't get people to come for those jobs. Now, of course, As people get made redundant, perhaps they'll become less fussy. But there is a belief in the private sector that we've had a cushioned generation who've gone easily into the public sector and are going to have a big wake-up call. So that's what I would say on that. And also an indication, and there are people here who know more about this than me, that just recently, in the immediate past, the private sector is starting to recruit from Eastern Europe again. You know, it was a big surge of it a few years ago, and then it dropped off, and now it's come back again. So there are big challenges there. As far as the thing overall is concerned, I mean, Osborne was just biting the bullet. I mean, you were actually there. I mean, he knew he had an unpleasant package to propose. I think the government's business managers will be a little concerned at the whooping and cheering that went on to accompany it. I think probably Cameron wanted a fairly low-key response from the Tories, but obviously when Alan Johnson got up, there was a temptation to do that, and he was able to fire in what I thought was a fairly effective performance. He may not know much about economics, but I think we saw some PR skills from Alan Johnson. But, I mean, overall, my final comment is that this is really going to define this Parliament now, isn't it? Mm. Now it's a race to see whether by 2014-15 the green shoots start to show through, because if they don't, then the pain won't have been worth the game.
Mm. I mean, there's two things that struck me from the debate itself. I mean, the first is exactly what you've just said, Jim, the fact that some of the Tories were actually cheering as the cuts were being announced to the public sector. And that seemed to me to be a little bit daft, if nothing else. Even if it was something that you wanted to celebrate, you'd have kept it to yourself. A little bit like if you were sat amongst all the Liverpool supporters last Sunday, for example, as an Evertonian.
It's only 3 minutes into the program.
But the other thing that I think more problematic going forward was the faces on some of the Liberal Democrat MPs, because they did not look happy. And I wonder how palatable some of the changes that Osborne is planning is actually going to be to those Lib Dems. Have you picked anything up across the region as far as the Liberal Democrats are concerned?
I think there is unease. I mean, certainly, I mean, even before this statement, John Leach, who's a Liberal MP in a university seat, has absolutely said he is not going along the whole question of the student grants and student loans and all that. I mean, he's going to vote against it. And I think there are others. John Pugh, I think, is one to watch in Southport. He's been very uneasy about it. But, I mean, that's the other thing. Of course, as Alan Johnson said, there will be some Conservatives who have a completely different project. It's not just about dealing with the deficit and getting that down. It is in shrinking the state. And, of course, the Liberal Democrats wouldn't necessarily, well, not all of them, I mean, I think some of them may be, but I mean, most of them, certainly up here, are not in the business of politics in order to shrink the state. I mean, they believe in education and a flourishing public sector and all that sort of thing. So I think there will be considerable unease. But, you know, the votes are there, and Danny Alexander has been praised to the hilt for his work as Chief Secretary to the Treasury. I mean, some people have said he's shown more enthusiasm for this task than George Osborne has. Yeah. And there are these, what they call the Orange Book Liberal Democrats, yeah, who are beginning to emerge with great relish for this. Now, I don't know whether it's just because they think they did the deal on the coalition and they feel they've got to be good members of the coalition, but I think they're losing all contact with their party. Mm.
It is interesting, I think, the context of all of this, because Laws, of course, was very much seen as an Orange Book Liberal, and he's been replaced by someone very similar political background. Vince Cable, of course, very different type of Liberal Democrat, you know, and I would suggest perhaps more left-wing than some people who are sat on the Labour benches at the moment. But let me come to John Egan. John, obviously, as Jim has referred to there, we are heavily reliant on the public sector in this part of the world, probably over-reliant. I think that's a fair assessment. But I think all of us are concerned that these cuts may be too quick, if nothing else. Do you think he's got the balance right? And do you think some of the measures that he's taking around welfare reform, for example, and public sector pensions, which most of us sat around the studio today can only dream of picking up those sorts of figures in our retirement. Do you think he's right to address those sorts of issues, at least?
Just really following on from Jim's comments about the ideological element to what the Tories announced yesterday, and the extent to which it was about dealing with the budget, or it was about indulging their ideology and their political project. I think there are times when Tory political philosophy begins to kind of resemble the Wicker Man. They're like a primitive society that, you know, if we offend against the forces of the economy and the market in the way that ancient societies sinned against the forces of nature, you've got to find some ritual sacrifice And no doubt they were jumping around and engaging in sort of primitive, visceral behaviour, because what they were actually seeing was the ritual sacrifice of the public services and welfare recipients and all the other obvious targets of Tory venom. So it was very, very dispiriting to see that and to sense that that was at least part of the motivation and part of their project. Coming on to the public sector cuts and what they mean for this city region, I think it's you know, I think Jack Stopforth, in interviews he's done over the last few days, has pointed out really the extraordinary vulnerability of the city region economy because of, as Jim said, the overdependence on public sector employment. And this is clearly something we're all familiar with. It's something we're all trying very hard to diversify the economy in the city region to wean ourselves off that dependency. But, you know, there is absolutely no way anybody can dream that the private sector is going to grow at a rate to absorb the consequences of those cuts in the public services in this area. If you look at areas where the private sector growth has been focused over the last few years, the kind of drivers for our economic recovery, it's been retail, it's been leisure, and it's been construction. And actually, there are three sectors that are also going to be probably very heavily hit as a consequence of the announcements made over the last couple of days. Retail and leisure, you know, is driven by demand, and public sector redundancies reduces demand, so they're vulnerable. And construction is very much fueled by public sector driven projects. And of course, particularly in the housing sector, they look more than vulnerable. They look as if they've just been decimated. Really dispiriting, I guess, was where he focused on those areas of potential growth and said, well, look, guys, it's not all bad news. I mean, you know, we're trying to restructure the economy. We're trying to find some areas where the economy can grow. And he, funnily enough, identified a number of areas which overlap with the city region's multi-area agreement and its economic strategy in terms of science and knowledge, low-carbon economy and culture and tourism. Except all the announcements he made were completely pointless as far as we're concerned, because science, research and investment is going to be focused in Cambridge, Oxfordshire, that's Oxford in the southeast. Culture and tourism important to the UK economy, yet the only major projects that got the thumbs up were all focused in London, the Olympic Games, the Tate and the British Museum. And in terms of low carbon economy, the tax changes around the carbon reduction programme are actually going to provide a massive disincentive towards investment in low carbon technologies. So there was very, very, very little to cheer from the point of view of this city and the city region economy.
I know politically it's difficult for us to accept that some of this medicine actually just had to be given. But I think that on welfare, for example, you know, people who I would naturally consider to be socially liberal have expressed the opinion to me that they are sick and tired of people, even during the past 10 years when we were in the good times, who've been happy, in their words, to sit at home drawing benefits. And Jim's already referred to this fact that, again, many in the private sector now are having to go to Eastern European labour to fill some of the vacancies because, well, either we haven't got the skills base here, which would be a pretty poor reflection on the amount of investment that's been spent on education and training during that decade, or, and we have to accept this, I think, there are people out there now just happy living on benefits. And surely, John, we can't accept that that is an acceptable way,
Frank,
for our society to continue.
Of course, yeah, but it's a truism, isn't it? Nobody's going to stand up and say, no, sponging, it's a great occupation. Good luck to them. Let them get away with it. You know, shameless, fantastic. But, you know, hard cases make bad laws. And to some extent, this is public policy driven by focus groups. You know, you cannot reconfigure the benefit system on the basis of public outrage at the antics of particular benefit fraudulent claimers or particularly work-shy or shiftless individuals, because the consequences of the changes they made will extend massively beyond, you know, these largely apocryphal elements of the community. I mean, who are we talking about? We're talking about the cast of the Jeremy Kyle show. But you can't drive politics on the basis of you know, a TV audience or what focus groups are telling you or some easy targets or finding a few scapegoats.
But there is, John, I accept that, but there is
a huge
welfare bill that this country now carries. Now, whether or not you accept that there are millions, hundreds or thousands of people who actually are quite happy to sit there, draw and benefit.
Yep.
There are three things that I actually think that the Chancellor basically had every right to explore and has every right to attack. One was the pensionable age, which I think, given life expectancy in this country now, it's just daft to keep it at 60 and 65. So I actually think he could have been more radical there and put the retirement age up to 70. And that's what I'd have done if I'd have been him. The second was public sector pensions, particularly for the chief officers of local authorities. And in this city, we have seen time and again people walking out of the town hall with gold-plated checks and deals that, quite frankly, have been an absolute outrage and we will never see in the private sector to the extent that we've seen just in this city, never in the rest of the UK. And the third area, I have to say, is welfare reform. Now, Paul Flanagan, who has been somebody campaigning, committed to employing local labour for years and years in the construction sector and in the leisure sector as well. More than one occasion, Paul, you've said to me, we would love to employ all Liverpool staff, and by and large you do, but there are areas where you just can't get people to do the jobs, can you?
Yeah, you're right, Frank. I'm still trying to visualise... It was Briss Eklund and the Wickerman that John was saying in the Parliament. So
Esther, yeah, McVeigh.
It was Esther. I'm just looking at that picture there. Yes, she'd make a good Briss Eklund. Yeah, you're right, Frank. In the construction, we don't employ any of the Eastern Europeans or anyone from around the city. Simply because the ones that I've come across, they don't strike me as good tradesmen. The hard workers. You know, they're certain multi-trades, but they're certainly not what we regard as tradesmen. So, but in the leisure, that's the one where most Eastern Europeans are getting the jobs. And I honestly think it's the case of our own, you know, Liverpudlians or Merseysiders, whatever, think it's below them, and they don't look at it, you know, in some cases, it's a job with a career.
And given what John was saying, it's one of the few growth areas that we've experienced, really, isn't it? Service sector, leisure, bars, restaurants, hotels.
And, I mean, when, you know, we are in the leisure, say, you know, our restaurants or the cafe sports and that, you know, we're trying to attract people with personalities, and you won't get any more big personalities than, say, Scousers. The problem with the Eastern Europeans and that is the hard workers, but there's, you know, they haven't got that personality. They haven't got that warm welcome, what you'd expect from some, you know, someone from working in Liverpool. So, you know, we do our level best to employ locally, but we struggle. And I just think that it's a case of what I said before. Some people think it might be below them to be a waitress or a waiter or bar person, you know. But the minimum wage is done away with all that sort of, you know, exploitation. You know, so I don't know what the argument is really with them, but we do try and in most cases succeed with employing local in the leisure. But, with, you know, put me on that we have got people from out of town working for us.
Yeah. And Jim, just the issue of public sector pensions, again, it's a hot issue, isn't it? I mean, it's something that does get people in the pubs and clubs, as they always say, talking, and it drives people round the twist, to be honest, because, as I say, pensions, particularly in the private sector, nowhere near as generous. And when you're trying to compete for staff, you know, I mean, we know a number of private sector companies over the past few years who've lost really good staff, not because the packages are poor, but simply they can't compete with what the public sector are offering.
Well, maybe we're going to see attitudes will have to change. I mean, local authorities are going to be looking at what sort of pensions they're going to be offering. But, of course, the problem with the pension thing is it's so long-term to have any effect. But I imagine, you know, going forward, local authorities recruiting people will be on a very different scheme altogether. But, I mean, you can use an abusive term, shrinking the state, and, you know, people think that's an ideologically driven thing and it's bad, but when I hear Paul talking about that sort of attitude about not wanting to work in a bar and so on, well, maybe that will change if the benefits are cut off. I mean, some of these benefits that people have been on, like the employment benefit and so on, it's actually going to stop after 1 year. So we'll see what their attitude is to working. I mean, it sounds awfully brutal. I don't mean it like that.
Jim, it is awfully brutal, to be perfectly blunt.
Well, if someone's got an attitude that they'd rather be on benefits than doing what they call a low-grade job and being pleasant to people and serving a few people.
Well, it's not, you can't have the argument of self-esteem either, can you? Because if you've got self-esteem, you'd rather work in a bar than sit at home on the dough watching Jeremy Kyle. I mean,
it's simplistic and glib to think that the only impediment towards getting long-term unemployed people back into work is the fact that they're on benefit. It's a very complex situation. It's generational, it's social, it's cultural, it's about lack of education, it's about lack of mobility, it's about lack of self-confidence. It's one component in it, and it is idiotic for this government. Laziness is part of it. In some instances, it is part of it, but it's part of it. And we now seem to have collapsed into this narrative that all you need to do is basically give people a big kick up the arse and they will sort of miraculously land in a job somewhere or other.
But don't you think, John,
possibly by getting on their bike, no doubt.
Yeah, but
and
John, don't you think...
It's the same with housing benefit, Frank. I mean, yeah.
Let me just stop you there, John, because don't you think that one of the problems of the 13 years of a Labour government was that actually that was an area that could have and should have been tackled perhaps more fairly, perhaps in a more balanced way, but it was actually an issue that was ducked. And similarly with public sector expenditure. I always say to people now, say to me, oh, the Labour Party overspent. I always say, whoever took control of our government in 1997 had a very similar choice to the government that came to power in 2010. But it was in the opposite direction. Whichever government would have been elected in 1997 had to spend, because our hospitals were falling down, our health service was in a mess, education was in a mess, the infrastructure of the country was going to pot. So whoever would have come to power in 97 had to go on a spending spree. And Labour did that very effectively. My biggest criticism of Labour during that period, in terms of its domestic policy, was that it handed out the goodies to the public sector without the necessary reform. And what we've seen is waste. What we've seen is, as I say, gold-plated pensions. And what we've actually seen is an unreformed welfare system that has got out of control. And that's why Osborne is being allowed
The size of the welfare system does highlight a failure of New Labour. It's the failure of New Labour to reconfigure economies in areas where, through the 1970s and 1980s and the 1990s, the traditional economic base was decimated for reasons of public policy, for reasons of flirtation with neoliberal economic theories and the consequences of globalisation. But actually, I've never had anybody talk more eloquently about the kind of realities of economic life in North Liverpool than Paul. Mm. If you take major employers who have provided cohesion to those communities, as well as employment to the people that live in those communities, you take them out of the equation. The impact is profound and traumatic, and it's never, ever, ever been dealt with, or a new economy has been created to fill that vacuum. These are communities that have no economic raison d'etre.
I do take his point that getting people into a position where they are capable of working and providing the right attitude, getting up in the morning, is going to require a lot of people working alongside them. And I think all we've seen so far is the brutal sort of cuts. The employment service and all that sort of thing. Are they going to be beefed up? I doubt it. In order to help people on an individual basis, we'll have to see if that happens.
Mm. I'm trying to be as positive as I can as well about some of the Chancellor's statements, because there was some good news contained within his statement, not least the electrification of the North West Rail Line, Manchester to Liverpool. Well, the Runcorn Bridge, but nobody seems to know who's paying for that yet, so I'm still waiting to see the detail of that. But, Roger, I know that you listened to the speech and to Alan Johnson's response. What did you make of it all?
I preferred Alan Johnson's speech more than George Osborne's. I think that it's too swift. I think the cuts are going to run far too deep. Can we absorb in the private sector the potential over 4 years of, how many was it, 500,000 redundancies? And you know, I don't go along with the, this idea that it's going to happen naturally, that, you know, people will go out and they won't replace them. You know, it's going to affect the private sector enormously, and I don't think there's the room there to absorb all the redundancies. And I think this whole thing of, you know, of employing Eastern Bloc people, and I take on board what Paul says, you know, they are hard workers, and I think, you know, it's a bit of a domino effect in terms of, if you take what John's saying about the generational impact on, or the generation effect that has on people who are unemployed. But I don't know which party I come from here, but I think we've got to start looking after our own before we continue to bring in Eastern Bloc workers.
We have no choice. They are members of the European Union. This is one of the things that the politicians should have made clear at the time. One of the, you know, we wanted Eastern European countries in for all sorts of geopolitical reasons about, you know, the end of the Cold War and all that sort of stuff. But the British people were never clearly told what the implications were.
But is it free market? Yeah, I understand the whole thing about free market, and I think free market plays a massive part to the national economy growth and the global economy growth. I get the whole point of, you know, the fact that we can't afford to pay for what we're bringing in. You know, in terms of imports and exports, we're not exporting as much as we are bringing in imports. But regulation seems to me to be very, very fragmented in terms of who we allow into the country. And you know, some of these people are coming into the country, and I don't want to sound xenophobic here. I'm not at all, you know, and I've said this time and time again, my brother lives and works in Holland.
Well, that's the deal, you see.
I know, but this is why I'm struggling.
But the problem, of course...
Let's bring Paul in, because obviously he's got some experience of this.
I agree entirely with what Roger's saying, but if I was to go out or put it elsewhere, what do you get called? Mm. You know, you more or less get called a racist, don't you? You know, you know, that's what everyone's scared of, getting called a racist. But call me a racist then if I'm protecting Liverpool jobs for Liverpool people. Fair dues, I've got a broad pair of shoulders. I'm not going to get put in prison, but I was just thinking I'm not really a political animal in that, you know. But I think Chairmit, you know, we said something before about competing. You know, we've got to compete now with the private sector. You know, how is the private sector supposed to absorb all these cuts? But one thing that the governments haven't mentioned, and I think it's going to be the underlying weakness of what they're trying to achieve, is that for the private sector to absorb all these, employ more people, they need to grow. And obviously you need to grow, you need to borrow from a bank. And let's have it straight, the banks of Britain or Great Britain or UK are closed for business. So how can we, or businesses in the UK, grow when you knock at the door of the bank and say, listen, I want to borrow some money, and they go, whoa, we're closed for business. Now, I haven't heard or read anyone saying...
Though, in terms of the bank, because George Osborne, now, if you remember, he did announce that there was an independent banking review commission being set up.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, fantastic. A banking review, John.
So there you go.
The smoke screen is they don't have to report until next year. So yet again, the banks get let off.
But I think that, again...
Sorry I interrupted you there, Paul.
When you look, I think Paul's right in terms of the banking sector being let off the hook here, because, again, if you think about what the conversation's been about this morning, and indeed the conversation leading up to his announcement on Wednesday, it has been about public sector expenditure. It's been about the welfare bill. It hasn't been about the cause and effect.
Yeah.
The people who actually started this crisis were the bankers.
The banks,
and the people that nobody are talking about anymore are the bankers. And so for the mistakes of the bankers, the people who are in the public sector and people who rely on welfare are going to get smacked.
Yeah.
And I think that really is perhaps something that the opposition ought to have picked on a bit more quickly.
It's not entirely true. I mean, to be fair to Osborne, he's getting them all. I know you're going to react to this, but there is this code of practice which only about three or four have signed up to, and by the end of next month, they've all got to be signed up to it. And also, he's instituting, finally, the the bank levy, you know, that's going to be put into statute. I mean, I've done various programmes during the course of last week, and the anger amongst the public saying, you know, why are we paying for this? It's very high, and I think the government have got to respond to it. But
Alistair Darling was interviewed on BBC Radio.
You can tell us about Alistair Darling after the break, Rods, because we're fast approaching the bewitching hour. When we come back, we'll be talking a bit more about the budget. Paul's just back from Shanghai, so we'll be asking him how the expo is going for this great city of Liverpool.
Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. City Talk 105.9.
Well, welcome back to the show. I'm joined in the studio this week by Paul Flanagan from the Flanagan Group, John Egan from Aurora Communications, political correspondent, LDP columnist Jim Hancock, and the downtown events manager, Roger Jonas. We were talking before the break about the Chancellor's comprehensive spending review announcement. Just a final thought from each of you on where you think this leaves us, where you think it's going to take us over the next 4 years of this government's reign. Roger.
Well, actually, before I was so rudely cut off by you at the break, Frank, I was just pointing out that Alistair Darling was interviewed on TV and they were talking about bankers' bonuses. And he was citing that it was a contractual thing, so they had little choice. I'm just wondering what sort of contracts all these public sector workers have got, and whether they have a choice or that it confused me, to be honest. I was quite irritated by his comment, because I still think the banks need to pay more, stick a levy on them, do whatever. But I'm disappointed that Osborne didn't cite the banks far more. In terms of the state that the country's in now.
Well, I mean, £2.5 billion is going to be brought in by this levy, to be fair to George Osborne. I mean, I think overall at the moment, the government has public opinion on its side. There's a sort of masochism around that people want some action. And I know you've been chastised for your views, Chairman, but... You know, I think with the welfare benefits, there is a bit of a backlash at the moment. It may be distasteful, and I take what John's saying, but I think there's a public head of steam. They like politicians working together. They think there's a need to rebalance the economy. They do think some people have been taking the mickey out of the welfare benefit system. And so for the moment, you know, there is quite a lot of support. And one should say, I mean, Esther McVeigh writing in the LDP last week listed the various things that are going to help. £2.5 billion for this pupil premium. Not her idea, it was actually the Liberal Democrats' idea. £150 million on a national scholarship fund. £600 million to be spent on refurbishing and updating schools in another form, not the one that has hit Liverpool so badly. So, you know, there have been some plus points as well. And I think for the time being, there might be a fair win. But I do think people agree with these things in general principle, and when it's their daycare centre that's closed, or we see some really horrendous decisions being taken about taking people off invalidity benefit and so on, being put through pretty humiliating tests, the climate could change, and in 2013-12 could be very dark years for this coalition.
John?
Just a very local perspective, I think. It would be very interesting to see how the country's performs economically in response to this, and whether we do begin to slip into a double dip recession, which we all hope won't happen. But my fear is that even if that doesn't happen, you know, some regions, some cities, places like Merseyside could be more adversely affected than other parts of the country because of that level of public sector dependency. And if that begins to happen, and the economic progress we've made over the last 10 years, you know, begins to be eroded, then I would like to think that this new Tory government, with this much more pragmatic and socially progressive approach, is prepared to rethink its policies and support the absolute need. And this is, you know, I totally agree with Jim's point. We need to restructure our economy. We need to wean ourselves off this level of dependency. But, you know, that does require some degree of government support in terms of where they support investment and supporting some of those sectors that potentially provide a basis for longer-term prosperity for the city. And I think, you know, it's just the government being attuned to the needs of particular regions who are particularly vulnerable.
Just to pick up on that point as well, John, one of the big things that the Tories are going on about is localism.
Yep.
And yet it does seem to me that this is a one-size-fits-all approach to government expenditure cuts.
Yep.
Because actually, to say every single local authority has to cut 7% every year every single locality have to follow this tic-tac, does not recognise the disparities that still exist across the regions of the UK. And I think that is where fundamentally my concern is with the budget announcements that the Chancellor made.
It exposes the hollowness of the claim to be fair and exposes the hollowness of the rhetoric about all being in this together. I think that their perspective is very much forged by where they are in the leafier, more prosperous parts of the country. And the general, a level of ignorance, I think, about economic reality outside and beyond the individual horizons.
And the great regional, the great voices for the regions. I don't want to go on about this today because I'm a broken record on this subject, but the great voices for the regions are being dispensed with. And we're all going to be trooping off to Whitehall with our penny packet bids for money. I don't think the LEPs are going to be quite big enough in order to provide that critical mass.
Well, the LEPs are in a bit of a mess from all accounts. Again, from the conversations I had during the week, a lot of members of Parliament now not expecting to see LEPs operating in a number of areas, including Liverpool. You know, Manchester looks as though definitely going to get the green light. Lancashire's in a mess, and Liverpool maybe have to take another look from what I'm hearing, but we'll come back to that another time. Final word on the comprehensive spending review from you, Paul, as a businessman and entrepreneur. Was there anything in there that you spotted that you thought, actually, that's great news for me? Or is it a case of wait and see, do you think?
Wait and see. There was nothing in it for me. Mm. Or, you know, other businesses. Well, businesses that I know in the city. I mean, an extra bridge in there. You know, is that just the people come in and get the jobs and go back out again every day? I don't know.
You might get the
kids building. I might get that show. I think here, I'm just thinking, if the worst comes to the worst and the country goes bust, why don't we let do what the Greeks have just done and let China buy them? Because what I've seen is that's the way forward. Communism is the way forward.
So Liverpool entrepreneur Paul Flanagan says communism is the way forward. It actually links us nicely to what I want to talk about next, which is Liverpool's involvement in the Expo, but on a broader level than that, really. Again, we've spoken about the impact that the Chancellor's announcement is going to have on Liverpool City Council, a 7% reduction in spending over 4 years, year on year. That is a big, big reduction in spend. Now, one of the things the City Council does is help to finance things like the MIPIM property fair and the city's presence there. It's funded, obviously, our involvement with the Shanghai Expo, and it gets involved in lots of other festivals and events as well. Matthew Street Festival is one that we've recently spoken about on this programme. Again, if I may start with you, John, do you think that the City Council now are going to have to be far more pragmatic in its approach to this type of spend, or actually do they have to prioritise the marketing and promotion of the city given the amount of money that is generated through that sort of activity? Yeah. I'll give you a quick statistic from this week. The MOBO Awards, we're told, has generated somewhere in the region of £10 million for Liverpool.
No, I think they've got to be intelligent and consistent in what they invest in terms of marketing and positioning. I'm not particularly disturbed or upset by the decision not to go to MIPIM. I could never see. I think you ask people what particular deals were done, what particular investments were secured as a consequence of a week on the Riviera, and people generally scratched their heads and said it was a wonderful networking opportunity, which is normally a euphemism for a whole variety of social pursuits, which I won't go into. But
I love the way he puts it, a whole variety of social pursuits. We know what you mean.
But you know, you're right. MOBO, Biennial, Matthew Street, to an extent. These are things that bring people into the city, that contribute to the prestige of Liverpool internationally and nationally. They're part of our brand. They help to reposition the city. They define its aspirations. They give credence to its claims to be a creative, dynamic, cosmopolitan city. You know, it's a lot of the stuff that Manchester is supremely brilliant at doing. But they've done it through, you know, not spending huge amounts of money, but being very intelligent and very consistent in the way that they've chosen what are the projects which we will use to showcase our offer and the projects which we're going to use to define what our brand is. And Liverpool just needs to be clever in the way that it prioritises its spending and not simply knee-jerk and saying, oh, God, we can't afford to do this anymore. Let's just concentrate on core services.
Mm-hmm. And I think the good thing about the announcement over Mippen was, alongside that, Joe Anderson making it very clear it wasn't because we were looking to cut back expenditure in terms of promoting and marketing the city, but he thinks it can be done smarter and better. And, you know, one of the initiatives that we've spoke about, John, the embassy in London, for example, and, you know, I guess that we'd all agree that that's probably money better spent than on a property fair, particularly where the market is at the moment as in terms of property investments anyway. But Jim, again, you've got this regional perspective and you've heard John's thoughts there on Manchester. He's absolutely right. The place has positioned itself supremely well in the market. But Liverpool has improved its performance in recent years, and I think it'd be a shame if we took our foot off the gas in many regards.
I'm looking forward to hearing what Paul's got to say about Shanghai, because I think you know, the city has done very well. I mean, you know, credit to both parties. It was a Liberal Democrats vision in the first place, but there was an issue about how much was spent on this final event, and Joe backed that, even though you could see what was coming down the track in terms of cuts. And I think that's been a great world stage. My only reservation about what John said, I don't really demur from what he said about Mippin, but of course Manchester will be there next year, and I'd hate to feel that a deal was done during the course of some social practices, perhaps, which led to some development going to Manchester rather than here.
But Manchester aren't going to have an embassy in London.
No, that's right. And I think the embassy thing's a brilliant idea as well. I mean, again, it's going to be coming to the private sector. I mean, are the private sector going to be able to come in and fill in the gap with the Matthew Street Festival and things like that?
Well, that's certainly, again, you know, all I would say is that I think the local authorities of Greater Manchester have been far more effective in engaging with the private sector. And I think the other thing that they did in Manchester was they didn't necessarily just look at the indigenous Manchester business community. They did go outside and get some, you know, blue chip companies to sponsor in a big way some of their bigger, higher profile events. And I think that's what we've got to do as a city. I think we're, you know, at the moment we're going to the same people to fund several things.
In Liverpool for doing that, though. Yeah, it's perfect, isn't it?
Massively.
Absolutely perfect.
But again, it's about ambition, it's about strategy, and it's about what John's just said, not being knee-jerk and panicking and just going with the one offer to our own business community and not thinking about the bigger picture.
Yeah. I mean, the boat show in 2011, what a coup for Liverpool.
Yeah. Massive opportunity.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And you know,
the track record's being built up now. Yeah. Going back to Sports Personality of the Year, the Liberal Democrat National Conference, Mojo Awards. You know, you can just turn to national
MTV. Fireman
Olympics.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry.
The Fireman Olympics.
Was Warren Bradley in that?
Moving swiftly on, we're trying to concentrate on something other than politics for this part of the programme. Paul, you've just got back from Shanghai. I know that you thoroughly enjoyed your experience and you were really impressed with what you've seen over there. The first question, really, I suppose, is do you think Liverpool has got its money's worth?
Well, that'll be the proof will be in the pudding, won't it, Frank? What comes back from it will Peel get what they wanted? Will Merseytravel get what they wanted? You know, there's a lot of other businesses out there. But, you know, hopefully that if they all get what they wanted, then great. But that's in the future. But on the sort of, you know, I was not a guest, but I went over there as sort of representing the Flanagan Group and see what our opportunities we could get. I think we were the only business. There was a few business, met up with George Dan, and George was over there. He's looking at, obviously everyone sees the Chinese or the Shanghai as an opportunity and what we can do. And it's a case of what they can do for us, in my opinion, not what we can do for them. And, my opinion was come over here and just exploit us and see what you can make, you know, and let us all ride on the crest of the wave where you're exploiting the city of Liverpool, because what they're doing over there is, I couldn't begin to describe or to say how good it is. You know, my first day there, it was total, I wasn't the only one, I felt totally disillusioned. I just thought what we're trying to achieve in Liverpool, and I was looking at what they've done in Shanghai. It's more or less growing in front of you. You know, when you see and you say, oh my God, where does this, how do they do it? Where's the will to do it? And it's just like, well, that's what answer my own question. The will's there. They make a decision and they just do it. Probably that's one
is,
of the
is problems. Is that part to do with risk? Are they taking a risk, you think, in the decisions that they make?
Well, on the, what we've done is we went to the ad day, a sort of a building the size of, say, our town hall, which was like a municipal gallery. And on one of the floors was the a model of the whole, not all of Shanghai, but the sort of the middle of Shanghai. It was unbelievable. It was every building in Shanghai was on this model. So, you know, you're looking at that and you're saying, well, 12,000 buildings over 20 stories high. So a good little story I had, we come out of the hotel one night and some guy introduced myself from English Heritage. I just turned around and said, well, you'd be in this place then, wouldn't you? And he went, well, what do you mean? You wouldn't live here, would you? I said, I'd live here tomorrow. So, you know, 12,000 buildings over 20, and right in front of our hotel was 26 stories. And right in front of us was a 70-story normal office block. And and they were all designed nice. The thing is, they've got money to spend on the aesthetics, no building there was, in my opinion, ugly, or you could see where the cut cost. You know, they don't mind spending on the aesthetics at the top to like put a hat on it. You know,
that's the attitude thing, isn't it? I was having a conversation last week with a guy from Mersey Maritime, and we were talking about the waterfront, and he was saying, yeah, that you know one of the problems with UNESCO and heritage is the fact that you could see from Hamilton Square one of the high rise buildings, so it's been blocked. Mm. Come on.
I know.
You know.
What do we want to do? Do we want to stay like this and the city goes? Mm. Or do we want to sort of emulate what other successful cities are doing?
And you've got to learn from others.
Well, to be fair, we're all waters in Liverpool waters. I mean, it's obviously not on the... Yeah. I mean, I'm just gobsmacked by what you just said. 12,000 buildings all over 20. I mean, that's just gobsmacking. But, I mean, the Liverpool waters and Wirral waters is massive in our terms. And there's some hope for that.
Yeah, there's plans, I think, have been approved over on the Wirral, certainly. And I think they're being recommended for approval over here, but they've had a hellish time trying to get them through.
Downscale.
Because of objections.
Yes, well,
through
we need to point out one political fact about the People's Republic of China, that it's a dictatorship, and you step out of line and you're either locked up or even worse. Yeah. I mean, that does impinge on, you know, if the government decides to do it, then there aren't any inconvenient obstructions on the way to do it, and they pay a very heavy price. How long the increasingly growing middle class of China will tolerate a totalitarian government is a very moot point, but that's one of the things. I'm not detracting from what they're doing, but I mean, you know, they...
I think it was one of the
economic miracle of the Pacific Rim and what's been replicated now in India. A lot of these countries aren't communist dictatorships,
that's true.
Are they?
That's true.
You know, Japan, South Korea, Singapore... India. I mean, you know, it's not actually down simply to the command economics economics of a Marxist state. Sure. It's the vibrancy of their economies and their entrepreneurialism. I think it's dead cute because I think that, you know, when Liverpool was a great world city, I'm lapsing into this nostalgic thing, but you know, when we were a great world city, it was at a time when we weren't sort of looking at London and saying, "Oh, please, can we build a railway, please?" Yeah. Or, you know, can we start trading with the rest of the world? Mm. You know, Liverpool's wealth was actually built on being outward-looking. It was built on seizing its own economic destiny and defining its global relationships and positioning itself in a global economy. Mm. Well, some of that global economy was utterly distasteful, but you know, assuming that our approach can be more ethical today than it was when we were trading on slaves, there is still that fantastic opportunity, particularly when there seems to be so little on offer in terms of what the central government and the UK PLC is offering Liverpool in terms of an economic future. Just go for it.
Well, that's why I think just, you know, we could have a relationship with Shanghai, but it seems, Paul, that you think really it's all going to be one way, you know, that we've got nothing much to offer them. Is that a fair
gateway? Well, I'd be unfair on Liverpool and to say that we've got nothing to offer. Yeah, we have got things to offer them, but, you know, our talents, you know, aren't competing with them on the manufacturing scale or on a finance scale, and that maybe we could teach them. It was interesting, a couple of meetings that I was fortunate to go on with Leader Joe, because one of his many titles, he got Leader Joe out there, which seems to stick. You know, President Joe.
The great leader.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I went over there with...
Next time you go, it'll be Chairman Joe.
Chairman Joe. I went over there with...
Elected manager.
Yeah. Optimistic, realistic ideas and whatever. So, but one thing I did notice, and, you know, I think I need to mention it, is that there's a few people who need to be commended for the way they were out, you know, what they've done over there, especially Vision. I was well impressed by Max Steinberg. I thought he was he'd done a fantastic job hosting it and, you know, being, you know, just overall leading the Vision team over there. And Mike Taylor, you know, there was an incident where I couldn't really mention, but the two of them got so passionate and aggressive about Liverpool that they couldn't hold back, and it's right in, you know, it was with the government office or the foreign office or whatever they are over there representing the UK. But they were right in, and I thought, well, that's what we need. I'm glad to see that. You know, one thing I've never seen, a bit of a passion like that. You know, so I think they needed to be, you know, applauded or, you know, congratulated. I think the Liverpool Vision team in total, I think it was about 30 of them, and they've worked the socks off. There was a lot of students out there who volunteered to work on the pavilion. They've really worked the socks off, you know. So the whole team out there, I would say, yeah, from, you know, for people who were sceptical about it, like myself, you'd have to go over there to see it. But, yeah, they've done a fantastic job. And I think for anyone who's concerned about what way the city's going to go under leader Joe, I thought, I'm not being sycophantic here, if it sounds like, but he was the star of the show. Mm. And the people of Shanghai were falling over themselves to please Joe, you know, and it wasn't like he's just leader Joe. It was because from the very first meeting he went on representing the city of Liverpool, it was bang. Mm. Yeah, oh yeah, we like it. Don't we? We're twins with Shanghai. Mm. And that was, you know.
Well, weren't you saying to me before that we've actually got a Shanghai Liverpool office out there, which, yeah, I must confess I didn't know anything about.
Well, I must confess, I didn't know nothing about it, but it's so interesting.
Twinning agreement.
It's a massive economy, and we've got our foot in the door, and we're looking at now, you know, with all the government cutbacks yesterday and that, you say, how do we compete? And that, well, maybe we can compete with, we've got our twin out there in the Far East that's got that much money and the sovereign wealth fund that it needs to invest in other you know, countries in the world. Well, that's, you know, we're at the door.
Yeah. Well, let's hope we can be kept on. It's good to hear that Vision have played that big part, because there's a bit of a question mark still hanging over
well,
the organisation.
Yeah, I mean, I think Liverpool Vision, for me, are one of the good news stories to come out of our city. I think it is a good organisation. I think under Jim Gill's leadership, it was a great organisation. I think Max Steinberg has simply continued that good work, and it will be interesting to see where Vision goes in the future. But no doubt it will have a major role to play in Liverpool's future, wherever it ends up sitting in the new structures that will emerge. Anyway, we've sadly run out of time. Thanks to my guests, Paul Flanagan, John Egan, Jim Hancock and Roger Jonas. Most of all, thank you for listening at the end of what has been a miserable week for people who benefit from massive public sector pensions, and for Liverpool supporters following last week's derby. I hope you enjoy a great week this week, and don't do anything I wouldn't do.
Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. City Talk 105.9. City Talk 105.9. Official podcasts. Online at citytalk.fm.